Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We are back with you live today. It's Wednesday, the 29th of September. I was gone Monday and Tuesday because I was up in Chicago speaking at a pastor's conference on the subject of gay marriage. It was a delightful time, in fact. And very nice having some lengthy conversations with some of the pastors up there and just being able to spend a little time relaxing in, you know, there's nothing more beautiful than driving through what looks like farmland and all of a sudden you're at a resort and you're in a canyon with beautiful woods around you and you wouldn't know you were anywhere near a big city like Chicago. It was a marvelous time and I'm glad to be back, however. Anxious to go home and see my family for the first time in 3 days, but we'll do that there in about 55 minutes when this hour of Issues Etc. concludes. Our guest in the first half hour of this third hour of Issues Etc., Dr. Alvin Schmidt. We've been doing an ongoing daily series with him on Islam, walking through his new book called The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. We're up to part 9 and to the issue of church and state, or in the case of Islam, we would say mosque and state. Now, both Christians and non-Christians in the Western world have observed at the very least a distinction, if not a separation, of church and state. Does such a distinction, does such a separation exist in the mindset or in the theology of Islam? We'll be answering that question and finding out what it means during this first 25 minutes. Then Pastor Scott Clems joins us for the last 25 minutes of this hour. We'll talk about the beauty of the church. He's from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored an article in the For the Life of the World magazine titled The Beauty of the Church. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, and as I mentioned, author of the book, The Great Divide. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Well, thanks back to people probably wondering, will he ever stop talking? So here I am again.
And our phone number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Schmidt, we do observe at least a distinction, if not a separation in the Western world, between church and state. Is there such a thing in Islam?
No, absolutely not. It's a heresy. And when in Turkey it was implemented in a quasi-fashion, if you will, in the 1920s under Mustafa Kemal, often referred to as Ataturk, there was an attempt made. And there is some separation of the state from the mosque, but it's highly resisted by many Muslims, and in recent years, a lot of more conservative Muslims have been trying to gain power, and eventually, hopefully, they would think that you can undo it. No, because as I mentioned in the book, the state and the church are like Siamese twins, or the mosque and the state, I should say. The mosque and the state, let me repeat that again. They're like Siamese twins, they're inseparable. And to separate the two is seen as a Western Christian heresy, because Islam sees religion as the state and the state as religion. And that's been true from the beginning of Muhammad. It was very much repeated by Ayatollah Khomeini when he took power in 1979, came out of exile, and it's true in all the Muslim countries. For example, even in Saudi Arabia, other churches cannot even exist who would like to be separated from the state. And this is, by the way, it's interesting when we hear people in the West talking about even Islam wanting democracy. What you never hear, and it's kind of conspicuous by its silence, they never talk. I've never heard any Muslim talk about advocating the separation of the mosque from the state. That's simply not part of our value system. In fact, it's one that's very contrary to their basic religious theological beliefs.
Is this why the State Department recently reporting on abuses or the lack of religious freedom in the nations of the world had its top list, and I think it was a top list of 7 or 8 nations that were called nations of particular concern? Why 5 out of that 7 or 8 were Muslim nations?
And you're asking what? Pardon me.
Well, the State Department observed that there was a lack of or a total absence of religious freedom in these nations, and five of the nations that it mentioned
were
Muslim nations.
Yes, of course. Along with the refusal to separate the mosque from the state means there is no religious freedom for Muslims or for anyone else. And that's the long and the short of it. It's simply not permitted. It goes against the Quran, it goes against the Hadith, and it goes against Sharia law. The Sharia law is very specific in terms of what it means not to separate the two.
Is this also one of the basic misunderstandings that we are operating popularly with, in particular our lawmakers and those who govern us, when they look out on the war on terrorism and they look at nation building and things like that in the Islamic world? Is it a basic misunderstanding that somehow you can have, under Islam, a separation of church and state?
Well, apparently they assume it, but you never hear them talk about it. That's what I said. It's conspicuous by its absence. Whenever they talk about democracy hopefully being introduced in, for example, at the moment in Iraq, you never hear the topic of separation of the mosque from the state coming up. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we tend to think, in spite of the conflicts we've seen, that we tend to think in terms of Western political beliefs, namely that if there's democracy, that is naturally going to happen. And not necessarily so, because you have only a minimal amount of that even in Turkey.
With the exception in the Christian-influenced West, and among Christians in particular, Dr. Schmidt, very few, with the exception of theonomists and Reconstructionists, would deny a distinction between church and state. Is it true that Christianity's influence has given Western civilization, at the very least, a distinction, if not a separation of church and state?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I don't know of any respectable political scientist or even theologian who would deny that when Jesus Christ said to the Pharisees who tried to entrap him whether it's legal to pay taxes to the Roman emperor, and he said, being wise to what they were up to, show me a coin whose inscription is on it. And they said, Caesar. And what did Jesus reply? Well, give unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and unto God what belongs to God. And as I said, any respectable political scientist, and by the way, back to the 4th century with already Hosius, a bishop who was stationed primarily in Spain, already used that as an example to have the emperor from interfering in church matters. Ironically, later on, it turned the other way around, that the church was interfering in state matters. But the point is that Hosius already in the 4th century recognized that the statement of Jesus applied to having the government not interfere in the church, and Luther likewise. Luther cites it, for example, in his Doctrine of the Two Kingdoms, the Jesus reference again, that this is separates the kingdom from the worldly kingdom over the spiritual kingdom being the one where we preach the gospel and convert people by the gospel, whereas the worldly kingdom is where the government rules with the sword, protects us primarily as citizens from the lawless and from attacks from other nations.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt in Part 9 of our 11-part series on Islam Today, the union of mosque and state under Islam. Miles is calling from his car. Miles, welcome.
Hi, I want to congratulate both of you for doing this show. I think you're brave and you're doing a good thing. My specific question is, I've heard some reports of Christians, and I hope you haven't covered this recently, I don't always get to listen, but Christians leaving Iraq where they didn't have to leave before. And I absolutely believe that I want Mr. Bush to get reelected. I don't want Kerry to get reelected, but I'm extremely troubled by the idea that that we've contributed to a situation that Christians have to flee from. If you could comment.
All right. Thank you, Miles.
And that's not the only place they've been fleeing from. Take, for example, Bethlehem. You had a large population of Christians and now dwindled virtually down to a very low number. And if you go back farther in history, for example, Constantinople, now called Istanbul, it had over the one time over 400 Christian churches. Now there are hardly any Christians left in Istanbul because it's been occupied by Muslims since 1453. And so wherever Muslim religion flourishes, Christianity begins to diminish, and it diminishes in at least two ways. First of all, they don't have any freedom. Secondly, they're often persecuted. And maybe even a third way, they leave. And that's what I said. If you go to Bethlehem, and, you know, there were a few years ago, and the numbers dropped since then. It used to be a high proportion of that population Christian, no longer so, because it's been largely taken over by the Muslim Palestinians.
And Miles, if you'd like a little more detailed information on that, we talked recently with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. If you go back a couple weeks in our website archives, you can find a brief conversation we had with him on the exodus of Christians from Iraq after the war and in its aftermath, and the urging of Christians who are staying there, Iraqi Christians who are staying there, trying to get Christians to remain for the sake of establishing some kind of toleration for Christianity under the new Iraqi government. They're trying to stay here. Let's see if we can establish by our presence some toleration for Christianity under whatever government may emerge there. And that's at our website at kfuo.org, and look under the Issues, Etc. section. Go back a couple weeks into the archives and you'll find this conversation with Uwe Simonetto.
I might also mention that they've been highly persecuted in Indonesia, Christians, by the hundreds, by the thousands in the last 5-6 years.
Looking back on Muhammad himself, is it safe to say that the template is set there at the very beginning of Islam, where Muhammad serves not only as a prophet, but also as a military leader and as, if you will, at least, as the prince of the people who would follow him, the lack of distinction between a temporal leader and spiritual leader?
Yeah, exactly. It begins with him, like so many other things do in Islam. They began with him. There have been a few wrinkles added in many ways, but most of it began with him, and that's exactly right. It did with him there, too, because he was both a... And, you know, the ardent defenders, the real conservative Muslims, for example, will say that Islam is perfect, and part of the perfection is that it doesn't have any separation of church and state. And again, we have to remember, as I said earlier, it almost sound a little bit simplistic, but it isn't. The church, or pardon me, the mosque is the state, and the state is the mosque. And Ayatollah Khomeini reiterated that again. Here's a quote from him: "Islam is politics, or it is nothing."
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from his car, Dave is on the line. Dave, welcome.
Yes, along the same subject, I'd like to hear a comment by a doctor concerning the threat to various other governments, such countries as France and Britain are getting quite a bit Islamic, and then also in this country, there's not very many, but as they build up, what is the nature that you assess as the threat to our own government situation?
Thank you very much.
Well, obviously, if we are uninformed, and it seems a great deal of that does seem to be present among the leaders of our country, we are simply permitting anti-forces, anti-relative to the separation of church and state as in our country, to gain momentum, which will continue to happen unless we begin to talk about it. You see, I mentioned a little while ago, we never hear that part. We may hear the discussion about women being veiled, and that's unfortunate. We may hear other parts, but we never hear this particular topic really ever aired. I haven't heard it in the news or even in the newspapers. It seems somehow it's just completely overlooked, and we can't afford to do that if we want to maintain our freedoms, and as it's well been established. Once the separation of religion from the state is lost, freedoms are lost as well.
Now, does it also explain what we've talked about so very often, and another thing that I find conspicuously absent in the conversation often about Islam, and that is that on the ground in Islamic nations, the local authority is not the tribal chief, or sometimes these are one person in the same. It is the imam in the mosque.
You're right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you again saw some of that in the recent newsroom. What's his name? I forget. The chief imam came after having had medical attention in England and replaced Sadr. You saw, again, the force and the power of he as a religious figure overruling or overwhelming the political forces there.
Now, you mentioned before Turkey. Again, if you would, respond to someone who says, look, it can work. Islam can not only, an Islamic nation can not only accommodate democracy of a certain form, but can have genuine, bona fide, full-blown separation of mosque and state and religious freedom to go along with it. Is that really the case in Turkey today?
No, it really isn't. It never really has been. I mean, yes, more so if you compare it to other Islamic countries, there's more freedom there. But, you know, Christians have never really had a great deal of freedom in Turkey. They, as a rule, often haven't been permitted to repair churches or have to go through great bureaucratic folder roll in order to get permission to do minor repairs in a church, difficult to build new ones and so on and so forth. Even and you know, when Kemal, or Ataturk, I should basically refer to him, in the 1920s instituted the separation of religion from the state. He was despised and he was hated. He was called an atheist. And since then, a lot of those separations have been relinquished in favor of the so-called Orthodox people who want to restore the union of the mosque and the state.
John is calling from St. Louis. John, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Dr. Schmidt, I had a question about Muslims in the military. If there is no separation between church and state, do you believe that Muslims who are American soldiers over there fighting are, in fact, a danger to the United States? Or can a Muslim American be a good soldier?
That's an excellent question. And I address it to some extent in my book in the last, in the 10th chapter, which we'll be talking about in the next interview. And, you know, you've seen a number of them have been arrested and charged American soldiers, even in this country, because where does their loyalty lie? Again, we can be, and I think we have often been, naive. We tend to think that the Muslims have been totally assimilated in this country, like to have, for example, Jews and Roman Catholics or people from various Protestant denominations, that there's, you know, and that the same thing is happening with Muslims. Well, that's a very basic fallacy. Why? Because they don't have a separation of religion from the state philosophy. And so when it comes to a choice, what will they choose if they're really true Muslims? Well, they will choose not separation of religion from the state, but to retain a union of them. Now, granted, there are undoubtedly many Muslims by name, nominal, to whom this is not a big issue in this country. But we don't know what the numbers of those are. We haven't got a clue, and we haven't even tried to find out. And I don't know if we could, if we tried.
What do you make of Christians who want nothing to do with the separation of church and state in our country or in the Western world, and they tend to see it as something that is anti-Christian?
Yeah, well, to some extent, we have abused the separation of church and state in our country in recent Supreme Court decisions and the like for the last 25 years or so. It's interesting when the founding fathers in this country gave the principle of what leads to the separation of church and state, namely the First Amendment of the Constitution. They never intended, as courts now are ruling, the separation of religion from the state, but that you know, or let me put it this way, no separation of from religion, but separation between the two. Where, for example, if you look at the early history of our country, Thomas Jefferson supported, for example, and the gave federal money to build Christian facilities and the like. There never was this radical view that we have today that somehow or another you can't even post the Ten Commandments on a public building. That's not what the separation of church ever advocated, but it's how we are now interpreting it. And so some of the people in Christian circles are horribly upset. I have to share with them their concerns, even though I still greatly believe in the separation of church and state, and ultimately I think they do too, as it was intended in the Constitution and had existed until the 1980s in this country.
However, I like to term it the distinction between church and state, because that seems to come even before any discussion of what's the relationship between church and state. That can hardly be a matter argued by Christians who are versed in Scripture.
Yeah, and if I may mention, I don't know if exactly addressing what you're saying, but, you know, and I meant to say it a moment ago, and I didn't say it quite well enough, but now to think about it, the separation of church and state was for people to have freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. And that's what it amounts to. You and I have freedom of religion, or even freedom of not having any religion. This is what's guaranteed to us in the Constitution of the United States, and for that matter, in most Western countries. But today we have moved that we must be free from religion, which is really an anti-force against not only the church, but even against freedom.
Finally, Dr. Schmidt, tomorrow night, many of our listeners, I imagine you, I will be watching the first presidential debate. Now, there are many issues to be debated, but in the context of foreign policy, of course, the war on terrorism, the rise of militant Islam will, of course, be at least part of the subject matter. Is this one of the missing ingredients from our Western view, popular view of Islam? Do we fail to see how important it is and how vital it is that in Islam they have a union of mosque and state?
Yes, yes, most definitely. And I tried to allude to that once or twice earlier in our conversation here. It's a major omission. And I tend to think it's the result of ignorance or even maybe some naivete that we interpret other religious groups in the context of what has been our experience in this country for 300 years, namely from most religion being of a Christian orientation, but even the Jews have, had no problem with having a separation between the two. But when you move to the Muslim Islamic circles, it's a horse of a different color, if I may use an old phrase.
Folks, you can purchase this book by Dr. Alvin Schmidt called The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West by calling Regina Orthodox Press, 1-800-636-2470. It's currently being offered for $5 off the regular price, 1-800-636-2470, or on the web at Amazon.com. Dr. Schmidt, with about 30 seconds here and no more. Next time,
we will be looking at whether Islam is a religion of peace, a phrase you have heard many, many times that I have addressed in this book and documented, and so that's what we'll be talking about next time.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, and he is author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. When we come back from this break, we are going to be talking about the beauty of the church with Pastor Scott Clems of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Stay tuned for that. Christians and Western people who inhabit Western civilization generally will accept at least a distinction between church and state. And there's a reason for that. Among Christians in particular, that is a distinction that our Lord himself makes between things rendered unto Caesar and things rendered unto God. A distinction between the realm in which Caesar rules in God's stead, of course, and the realm in which God rules through his word. We would do well to examine Islam for such a distinction as well. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
I guess you've probably seen the healing services on television, but do these faith healers have a biblical understanding of faith and healing? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for September is titled Order Restored, A Biblical Interpretation of Health, Medicine, and Healing. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Order Restored costs $20.99, plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about Order Restored on our website, issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section. How important are faith, attitude, and community in healing and wellness? Find out with Order Restore, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. 1-800-325-3040. Or look it up on issuesetc.org.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire. Baseball bidding adieu to Montreal, saying hello to D.C. Expos President Tony Tavares confirms the team is moving, saying Major League Baseball broke the news to him just before Washington officials began to celebrate the decision. The nation's capital lost the Senators when they moved to Texas and became the Rangers 33 years ago. He's there for the hurricane, staying for the debate. President Bush back in Florida today, touring a citrus farm owned by Marty and Pat McKenna near Lake Wales, Florida.
I know Florida's agricultural sector has been hit especially hard. Marty and Pat almost lost half their orange crop. I know a lot of other growers have lost a lot of crop, too. My budget request will provide vital assistance to the citrus growers and to other farmers and ranchers who suffered losses.
Bush has asked Congress for another $7 billion to help Florida and other states hit hard by Hurricane Jeanne and the three other big storms. Even though the president is ahead in the national polls, state surveys show the race a dead heat in Florida, just like last time around. Kerry advisor Mike McCurry says that makes tomorrow night's showdown in Miami extra important for both candidates.
It's the first, and it historically tends to draw the largest audience, and we know that. And so it's a chance to make, you know, in some senses, to make another first impression on the public that's still undecided.
Losing support among African Americans, John Kerry brought the Reverend Jesse Jackson on as a senior advisor today. He says voter registration is the key to the party's victory.
While we focus on voter registration, Republicans are focusing on voter suppression. Right now, the Department of Justice's main focus is not voter access, but quote-unquote voter fraud. One of the officials said in Michigan the only way they can win is that if they suppress the Detroit vote.
Scientists warning Mount St. Helens could erupt within days. They say the earthquake and tremors affecting the West Coast could weaken the mountain's lava dome. This is AP Network News.
Dr. Dean Wenthe, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on this year's incoming class.
For the first time, we have very fine core of gifted women. The Senate approved our deaconess program, and we are now at 14 new students in our deaconess program. Our MDiv program has, most recent count, about 80 entering students, and we are delighted with their quality. And one of them is a West Point graduate, and a number of them have had interesting degree careers as teachers and other very capable professions, but now are drawn to the wonderful vocation of being a pastor.
Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. www.ctsfw.edu.
Welcome back. Last 25 minutes of the program today, coming to you live this Wednesday, the 29th of September. Scott Clems is our guest. He is Director of Admissions, Public Relations, and Publications at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We're going to be talking about the beauty of the church. Now, is the beauty of the church something that is isolated only to its architecture, its art, and those things that are particular? I mean, you don't see stained glass and the beauty of stained glass in a lot of other edifices besides churches. You generally don't see the kind of statuary, at least the subject matter there, or the painting. How much of art, just in history, has been devoted to religious, theological, biblical, scriptural themes? Most of it. And most of it came from the heart of the church. But is that all there is to the beauty of the church, especially when we think about what St. Paul has to say about the church as the bride of Christ, being presented in all her splendor and her holiness and her beauty on the last day? Does she possess that beauty now in advance of the resurrection? We're going to talk about all of that during this last 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Pastor Scott Clems is also author of an article in For the Life of the World magazine titled The Beauty of the Church. Scott, welcome back to Issues, etc.
Thank you, sir.
First of all, let me thank you because you were instrumental in securing for us here at Issues, etc., rather generous underwriting from Concordia Theological Seminary up there.
Well, we appreciate what you do down there. It's to discuss Christ in this world and in this day and age is a very important thing. And we value issues, et cetera, and KFUO, and really the people of the church as they engage so many topics.
Now, when you started talking about the beauty of the church, I think the first thing that people think about is the outward physical beauty of the church. And you relate a story about a trip you took in your youth to Vienna, to Europe in general, but to Vienna in particular. Tell us about it.
Well, like many young people, I had a desire to throw on a backpack and go to Europe. And really, I think when you first get to a place like Europe where you have such a great architectural tradition, you walk in these cathedrals and it doesn't matter who you are. You're amazed by the amount of detail, the beauty, the art, the statuary, the gold. I mean, these are important places. They've been set apart for some reason, for some purpose. Very different. I was raised out in the western part of the United States where I think the oldest church I ever attended was built in 1950. Very different genre of architecture. And while traveling, I found myself in Vienna, Austria, a wonderful city. And it was a Sunday, and anyone who's gone to Europe knows Sundays are quiet days in Europe. There's no shopping, there's no commerce. And so I took a tour of a fine art museum in Vienna and signed up for a tour guide. I had never done that before, and my art history was not very strong. And there I ran into a very eccentric Englishman who was giving us the tour. And when we went into one of the main halls, and we see these statues, and there's a beautiful statue of Christ. And the first thing he does, he says, "Now you'll notice the statue of Christ." And he takes us immediately to the backside. And you're thinking, you know, what's this guy doing? And next thing I know, he's explaining the beauty of the drape of the robe and the spine and the back of the neck and the head. And he says, "Now, you might want to know that this statue was 60, 70 feet up in a cathedral, and no one could see this part of the statue. But this statue is unique in that this statue was carved for God. It's set apart. It's a piece of stone, but it's been set apart for Christ and his church and for God. And for God, we don't shortchange. We don't do things halfway, but we do them in all their splendor." He also told us to take binoculars and look at the stained glass windows in cathedrals. And so as you look into these windows, you suddenly see eyelashes and eyebrows and things in 100, 200-year-old stained glass. And again, the naked eye can't see them, but that's not the point. The point is that these beautiful things were done to be a witness that this is a special place. This is a place where God comes to meet his people. And therefore, like first fruit giving, in that we give to the church first what God has given us in our art, in our beauty, we need to give him everything we've got and to do it to the best and the highest.
Now, while we're still on that aspect of the church's beauty, which is we're here then talking about kind of an architectural or an artistic manifestation of the Christian's devout devotion and belief in the church's true beauty, that is found in Christ himself. But while we're still on that, you know, I've seen some of those cathedrals. We even have a few of them here in the United States. They're of much shorter lineage. These things in ancient Europe, they took lifetimes to build. The stonemasons who carved even just the basic square stones sometimes were generations in the task of building these things that stood out in a town and could be seen for miles around. Why were Christians so devoted to buildings that they could have simply put up something far more functional for worship?
Mm-hmm.
Why weren't they like we are today, where we just put up a steel frame building and say, "There's our church"?
You know, it's interesting. They saw the church as more than just a building to meet. You know, I've listened to some of your shows where you talk about the teaching office versus the preaching office and other aspects of the liturgy and the divine service. And, you know, these churches were places where God came to meet us and where we went to meet God. They were set apart from the world and everything in the world to reflect what we believe and teach and confess as Christians. And this witness to the world, there are numerous stories of history of people going into the cathedrals and actually finding a desire to learn more because of what they see. Also in art and architecture, it's a witness to the faith not only in the hearing of the word, But in the seeing and the beauty and the art and the architecture, some interesting stories. I mean, very simple. Here in the United States, we all have, anyone who has children, know from the children we learn so much. Well, my children, well, first of all, I didn't know Lutherans had crucifixes till I came to the seminary. Because out west, none of the churches had them. And in fact, I was taught that crucifixes shouldn't be in Lutheran churches. Now, I came out west, from the west to Indiana, and seems like every Lutheran church in Fort Wayne had some sort of crucifix in the front. So, raising my family in Fort Wayne now as I'm at the seminary, my children have been a witness to this visual feast in our church. We go to St. Paul's. And we were on vacation back in Colorado with my parents, and my daughter looked at my mom and said, "Grandma, where's Jesus?" And my mom, just kind of this typical grandma, "Oh, honey, you know, Jesus is here with us." And my daughter looked at her and said, "Grandma, where's Jesus on the cross?" You see, now, I didn't ever point out Jesus on the cross in the church, but my daughter saw that, the reality that Christ died for us, a very visual image of what Christ has done for us. And also then, architecturally, churches were a witness to the world, the pagan world around us, that this is a special thing, and this is a special place, and special things happen within the realm of this church or this cathedral.
I think about the buildings that are monuments to men, our state capitals, our state houses, and if you go to Washington, D.C., my goodness, the city is a city of monuments that are beautiful and awe-inspiring, and they are merely to men. Why is it that Christians don't make the connection when they have no problem with saying, build these great monuments to men, and then saying, well, but in our house of worship, we're going to keep it as functional and really as just an ugly plain as possible?
You know, I think we do see a lot of beautiful architecture in that the sacramental churches is where you tend to see it, where word and sacrament is. I mean, altar, font, pulpit. Really, the three emphases of a church like Lutheranism, where we have word and sacrament. And these indeed played an important part for really generations of architecture and liturgical architecture. I mean, all you have to do is drive through any of the Midwestern states and even out west, where you see these churches out in the middle of the countryside. I mean, little more than a dirt road, and you suddenly see this great pillar of a church. And so I would say that historically there has been an emphasis on architecture. Now, lately that has changed. And the question is, has our theology changed in that our architecture has changed? Has one driven the other? Well, you know, have we de-emphasized the sacramental of baptismal regeneration? As Luther says, every morning we should make the sign of the cross upon our foreheads and hearts as one's redeemed through baptism. You know, there's been a kind of a renaissance. We're starting to see fonts as you enter churches, and you almost stumble on them as you go in. You see that in the altar, Christ feeding us, or the pulpit, Christ speaking to us. And you see the emphasis to these elements within the architecture. You're right, there are churches out there that are being built as nothing more than a lecture hall or a place for entertainment where the platform is in front of the pulpit because the praise band or the singers become very important or the pulpit. An example of this even in the last 100 years is go to a church like Moody Church in Chicago, built in 1925. It was a bridge between, they felt architecturally, between Protestants and Catholics. And in that, you see outside a Romanesque and a really Byzantine entrance, and you're thinking this is going to be quite a cathedral inside. But you go inside, and it looks like an auditorium. And in fact, it looks, if you could take out some of the chairs in the bottom, you could put a basketball court in there. Well, the emphasis was on the speaking and the teaching of God's Word, but there is no sacramental emphasis. And in fact, it reflects the revival churches in that they met in these types of auditoriums and gymnasiums. And in fact, their architecture reflects their theology.
You're listening to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our guest, Pastor Scott Clems, has written an article in the latest issue of For the Life of the World magazine titled The Beauty of the Church. You can read it on the web at lifeoftheworld.com. All one word there, lifeoftheworld.com. Our call-in number, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Scott, you have written that the fine arts in the hands of believers seek to give form to the formless. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at, well, let's go back to creation. God created this earth. He created everything around us. He gave us beauty, first article gifts. God created me in all things, as we read in Luther's Catechism. And then, because of sin, we were cast out of the Garden of Eden, the place where God dwells. And now, through Christ, we are recreated, and we can enter into the presence of God. God comes to us through word and sacrament. And in fact, so we are in this place. Well, bricks, mortar, stone, paint, all come together to represent and to assist the believer in seeing the creation, in seeing the recreation. You think of stonemasons who create a font. You know, a piece of stone could be anything. But yet the artist takes this piece of stone and carves it into a bowl, a place where word and water come together. Water and word come together, and a child becomes a member of the body of Christ through holy baptism. So they bring these things together. And there is a correlation between art and the church. I mean, artisans were part of the church. And if you look at much of modern art, modern architecture, it seems formless or void. It's lacking that beauty. It's something of man and not something to try to represent God or his sacraments or his church.
If you have a question or comment on church art or architecture, call our number 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from Swansea, Monica's on the line. Hi, Monica.
Hi. I've got a question about altar positioning. I noticed this in several cathedrals in Europe, and I've seen it in a couple of Lutheran churches in the St. Louis area. These are usually older churches where the altar is against the wall. It's not out like a table that you can walk around like it is in a lot of churches. It's actually connected up against the wall. Is there significance to that?
Thank you, Monica.
Thanks.
You know, you see that, especially in the Roman tradition, Vatican II moved the altar out to a freestanding where actually the celebrant faces the congregation as he celebrates the sacrament of communion. And there is, while there is significance to that, there isn't a right way or a wrong way. We're not saying, we're not some sort of architectural purists who say it must be one way or the other. There's style, there's function. Many times in the older churches, in the Gothic churches, the altar was attached to the reredos, or the structure, the building that sits behind the altar. And in fact, as a pastor says the liturgy, they're facing forward, facing the altar, the reredos, with their back to the congregation, turning around. There was some theological thought that the pastor should face the congregation as he represents, as he celebrates communion, Christ's body and blood coming to God's people. Is there a right way and wrong way? No, not really. But in fact, they represent different times and different traditions within the church. And that's the thing. We're not necessarily repristinators in the church, meaning that we bring something back and say, oh, you know, all churches need to be Gothic or all churches need to be Romanesque. But in fact, they do represent the time and the period and much of the theological thought of the time of their construction.
One of the things that I find particular, and this is a matter of taste, I would say, but I find particularly beautiful is sometimes very, very simple, not minimalist, but more Spartan ways, where the simple elements of the church's life, where the pulpit and the altar and the font are there, but they're not ornate. They're very, very simple, yet still the beauty of the church emerges.
You know, one of the churches back in the 60s, really, you saw a lot of this type of architecture come in. You even see this at our own chapel, Kramer Chapel, at the seminary here in Fort Wayne. Another church that comes to mind is the chapel at Kansas University. It's the campus pastor, the campus chapel there. And it's a concrete building, but it's very stark in its art. It's very stark in its architecture. And the font, in fact, sits at the side of the altar. And it's in a special little alcove-type room. And, in fact, there's dirt on the ground around it, talking about, you know, baptism. From dust, Christ, we are created, and through water we're recreated. And there's a very simple, almost like a flue that goes above it, where light reflects coming out. And you're right, it's a very stark building, but very much reflects baptism. Our own chapel, Kramer Chapel, when you go in, it's a simple A-frame. And yet that simple A-frame uses light and very simple forms to separate and to make the emphasis be the altar, with all the stairs going up. You have a very strong lectern and a strong pulpit that, again, are very simple, but they also focus the believer on these things, that being pulpit, font, and altar.
And the goal there, obviously, then, as you have said before many times, is not to focus on the thing itself, but on what God does there. He speaks, he baptizes, he feeds us with Christ's body.
Exactly, exactly.
Scripture describes the church several places as the bride of Christ, but one in particular, I'm thinking about Revelation, the latter chapters, of the bride in all of her beauty and splendor. Mm-hmm. What is being represented in that vision that the Apostle John sees about the beauty of the church beyond what we can see with our eyes here in the church and its art and architecture? What is the true beauty of the church?
Well, the true beauty is Christ, that Christ is here, that Christ is the groom, and the church is his bride. And we see that when you think of, well, today is the Feast of St. Michael and All Angels, and the fact that we are surrounded by a multitude of angels. The Te Deum Laudamus that we sing in Matins talks about angels and archangels and the company of heaven, that in fact in the divine service we're not alone, but there's a thin veil between us and heaven. What a great comfort to someone who has lost a loved one to death, a Christian who has died and now is in heaven, that you can say, you know, as we partake of Christ's body and blood here, there's only a thin veil between us here on earth and your loved one in heaven. And there's a connection between us. And it's in this connection that you can find peace and comfort in the mourning of a lost one, or in the celebration of being together as a family of Christ. You know, it's interesting. I was talking to a pastor quite a few years ago, and his pastor who came out of the 60s, and he said, you know, they took great pride in their campus ministry at one point of serving communion on trash can lids. Because somehow we were going to talk about how, you know, the trash can lid doesn't change the validity of the sacrament.
Mm.
And I thought, how tragic, when this is the body of our Lord. Yes, you're right, we can serve it on a trash can lid. But should we really be serving the sacrament on a trash can lid or on something precious because of what this is?
Well, yeah, would you serve your daughter's sweet 16 birthday cake on a trash can lid?
Yeah, I can see my going home tonight and saying, hey, honey, I'm going to make a pasta dish. Grab a trash can from the garage so we can serve it up to the family. You just don't do that. And that, as the bride and bride of Christ, you know, you give the finest, the best. What can we do to return to Christ something of what he has already given to us?
Finally, on this subject, because I do want a few minutes to talk to you a bit about what happens up there at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, you say that the art and the architecture of the church not only teaches the believer, these things also evangelize the world. What do you mean with 1 minute?
Well, look at a church as it sits as a pillar to a community, as a steeple to the world with a cross on top saying that this is a special place. Christ died for you. Christ rose for you. And we want to share that message with you as you drive by in your car, as you go about your business, that this is a unique place. And it evangelizes to the world as an important place.
Now, have we lost that to a certain degree when we think it's all... We live in a visual society, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And in that visual society, we seem to emphasize the readily accessible visual, that which is immediately understandable to us, rather than those things that one must go deep into to understand. Images like art in the ancient world, or in the not so ancient world, where one had to actually spend some time looking at the thing to understand what the message was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say the contrary. If you look at these great cathedrals, in fact, things are very plain. I mean, you see a statue of Christ. You see Christ on the cross as he suffers for the sins of the world. We see in art, you're right, we don't flash screens with images of Christ's death and resurrection from the Passion or something like that. But an interesting witness, I a friend of mine, I wasn't always Lutheran, and during a time when I went to a non-Lutheran church, I became very good friends with a man who was my pastor. He came to Fort Wayne for the first time for my wedding, and we went to an Ascension service at St. Paul's. And after the communion service with the choir singing and the liturgy, and I looked over and he had a tear in his eye, and I'm like, what's up? You know, is something wrong? And he said, you know, you don't need all this TV stuff and all this pop culture. He goes, you've got it right here. Here I am sitting, praying the Psalms, hearing the choir sing, and I hear, take, eat, this is my body. Take, drink, this is my blood. What a powerful witness to a person who had never set foot in a Lutheran church of what we believe, who we are, and in fact that this is a significant place.
Final question. You are the director of admissions at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Why should someone listening to us consider becoming a pastor, and more than that, consider becoming a pastor under the training there at Fort Wayne?
You know, first and foremost, Concordia Theological Seminary is a worshiping community. We're a community of believers that have a heart for the lost. We have always been known as a missionary seminary, a place that trains people who love the lost, who want to go out and reach them with word and sacrament. So we are a worshiping community that comes together. We have men from across the world, literally. And we come together to reflect upon God's gracious gifts and how we can give those gracious gifts to others. You know, we hear off and on about clergy crises and, you know, are we going to have enough pastors? That's not the reason to come to the seminary. The reason you come to the seminary is that you have a desire to serve Christ in His church, that you have a desire to do the work of the church, that is word and sacrament, wherever Christ wants to place you. You know, you go where the church asks you to go, you do what the church asks you to do, and the rewards are tremendous.
And with only 30 seconds, what might a campus visit there at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne entail?
You know, there are a vast variety of things. I always tell men, come, bring your loved ones with you. We'll give you a key to a room. We'll give you a meal pass, and just hang in the chapel. Go pray with the men and the women who go here. Go to the classes and reflect upon vocation and what Christ may have in store for you.
Folks, if you would like a visit to visit Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, I'm sure Scott Clems would be happy to hear from you. Call 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or visit them on the web at ctsfw.edu. It's ctsfw.edu. Pastor Scott Clems, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, sir.
Pastor Scott Clems is Director of Admissions, Public Relations, and Publications at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He is author of an article in For the Life of the World magazine titled The Beauty of the Church. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about worldviews with Joe Belts of World Magazine. You want to tune in for this, by the way, folks, because it is very difficult to get interviews with the writers of World Magazine. It's not easy. Joe Belts will be with us tomorrow to talk about that. Also, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, part 10 of our 11-part series on Islam. We'll be talking about, is Islam a religion of peace? Dr. David Adams will join us of Concordia Seminary. We're going to be picking up on a recent Barna survey that says that Christians, and in particular born-again Christians, divorce at precisely the same rate as the general population. So we'll talk about divorce tomorrow with Dr. David Adams, and Dr. Jeff Waltz of Concordia University, Wisconsin will join us to talk about presidential debates. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.